The following is a rebroadcast of Valley Edition.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio in Fresno and Bakersfield, this is Valley Edition, FM89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's program, the South Valley could soon be home to a new power plant that would use coal to make hydrogen for electricity and fertilizer. And while project backers say the plant will be clean and environmentally friendly, some local farmers and air quality activists are crying foul. We'll hear a report from the Kern County community of Tupman about the controversy. We'll also talk about the confluence of gangs, drugs, violence, and poverty in communities up and down the valley, and hear the powerful story of one Tulare County teen caught in the middle. That's Geronimo's story, a special report from FM 89 and Capital Public Radio that you won't want to miss. That's all coming up on this Valley Edition, but first, these news headlines.
I'm Ezra Romero with these news headlines. California Governor Jerry Brown's administration has asked federal judges for more time to address prison overcrowding. As Marianne Rust reports from Sacramento, it's an effort to prevent the release of thousands of inmates this year.
A three-judge panel has ordered California to reduce its prison population by roughly 9,000 inmates by the end of the year. The Brown administration is asking the panel for a three-year extension. The request is based on a deal reached between lawmakers and the governors last week. The state is offering to spend money on treatment and rehabilitation programs and increased prison capacity to ease overcrowding, but notes in its court filing that these will take time. If the judges reject the plan, the Brown administration plans to spend about $300 million to house the inmates in private prisons and county jails instead of releasing them. The state has asked for a decision by late this month. In Sacramento, I'm Marianne Russ.
California reproductive health and civil liberties advocates are waiting for Governor Jerry Brown to take action on a bill that would create a more private way for patients to receive information about sensitive health services. Healthcare reporter Pauline Bartolone has more from Sacramento.
The measure would allow patients to direct an insurance company to send paperwork dealing with some health services to another address or by different means altogether, like a cell phone. Maggie Crosby of the American Civil Liberties Union says the change could help people feel more comfortable getting reproductive services, mental health, or substance abuse treatment.
For example, young adults who are scared to get HIV tests for fear of the disclosure of that information to parents.
Insurance claim information may be a particular concern to adults under the age of 26 who are still covered by their parents' insurance under terms of the Affordable Care Act. Crosby says victims of domestic violence would also be able to redirect health information.
Any health care that the patient says will put her in danger if it's disclosed to, say, a partner.
California health plans were initially opposed to the measure, citing administrative burden, but are now neutral. In Sacramento, I'm Pauline Bartolini.
Those little signs that warn of potential chemical hazards in buildings have morphed into big money for lawyers over the years. Some attorneys seek out businesses whose signs are out of compliance and threaten to sue unless the owner settles. But a bill sitting on Governor Jerry Brown's desk would reduce the chances for litigation. Democratic Assemblyman Mike Gatto has authored a measure that would charge owners a fine and give them a fixed period of time to bring their signs into compliance before they can be taken to court. Gatto says the suits have gotten out of control.
They have brought suit against certain small business owners saying that their sign was 1 inch too small or that they failed to warn their customers that beer could cause cancer, things like that.
Gatto says his bill would protect the public's right to know, while also shielding businesses from large legal fees. His measure doesn't address whether the signs are needed. Gatto says he may take that issue up next year. With Valley Public Radio News, I'm Ezra Romero.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. In the first half of today's show, we're going to talk about issues that plague almost every community in the San Joaquin Valley: gangs, drugs, violence, poverty, and dropouts.
issues that all share a common root. You hear about it on the TV news all the time. Another shooting, sometimes a murder, a drug deal gone bad, another senseless act that will only serve to start the cycle all over again. But what about the kids growing up in that environment? What's their story? And is there a way out? The story we're about to hear is about a Tulare County teen named Geronimo. But really, it could be about someone from Huron or Pixley or Porterville or anywhere in the valley. He's a kid caught in the middle between his gang and those who are fighting for him and for the future of the valley. He's a high school dropout, but his future is far from certain. It's a rare look into a part of valley culture that usually makes the news only after a tragedy. And that's why we feel it's important to bring it to you today. FM 89's Rebecca Plevin brings us this report.
From a young age, Geronimo Garcia wore a uniform to school. High socks, shorts, and a white t-shirt. It wasn't a school requirement. It was an older brother requirement.
They used to dress me up like a little gangster when I was young. To me, I always thought that was cool. But, you know, as I think of it now, I don't think that was cool when I was young. Come on. Looking at a little kid dressed up and gangster.
Since then, his clothing has determined who he hung out with at school.
In seventh grade, I got in a fight with the southerner because I was a northerner at the time. And I had all red shoes, and he told me to take them off, and I told him no. And I guess he said that he was going to stab me. And I said, you ain't going to pull out your shit, because I already got one right here. And took it out and stabbed him and started fighting him to the ground.
He'll turn 18 this fall. He's still wearing the uniform, minus the socks, but not to class. He dropped out of a school for expelled students this past May.
School was nothing to me. I wasn't learning nothing in school. So I did most of it all on the streets. The streets schooled me.
Today, Geronimo's caught in a tug of war. His experiences with the San Joaquin Valley's entrenched poverty, violence, and gangs pull him towards a life of hustling on the streets. His mentors try to steer him toward a degree, job skills, and a better life.
You know, I gotta change my life. I gotta do something about it, because if I keep following it, I'm gonna end up dead or in prison.
This summer, one of his brothers, Jose, was shot and killed, probably due to gang violence. He was 23.
And look where it took my brother's steps at. He ended up dead, and I don't want to go there.
Geronimo's story is raw and chilling, but it's the reality for many kids in the valley.
It is gangs that's big in the Central Valley, and it is drugs that is big in the Central Valley, and it is dysfunctional families big in the Central Valley, and it is poverty.
That's Scott Braden, the principal at Charter Alternatives Academy. It's the last school Geronimo attended.
And when you have those type of things, that's a recipe for disaster.
Geronimo's different, though, because he's resilient, says Manny Castro. He was a gang intervention specialist with Youth for Christ in Tulare County and now does similar work with the Visalia School District. He's been a mentor and father figure to Geronimo for a couple years. Castro says Geronimo wants a different life.
But, you know, just because of circumstances, because of environment, because of some cultural hooks, it's really difficult to break those chains, you know.
Those ties begin in Patterson Tract, the unincorporated community near Visalia where Geronimo lives with his family. His parents are Mexican immigrants. He's one of 14 kids. His street doesn't have sidewalks or streetlights. The first time I visited his house, his family was in the backyard cooking carne asada. It would have been Jose's 24th birthday.
It's a blue house, got some broken windows from drive-bys and stuff like that.
In more reflective moments, Geronimo admits his life has been shaped by the violent environment he's grown up in.
If my family was, like, not to be in gangs or in drugs or anything like that, I don't know where would I be at. I can't picture that.
You can't picture it?
I mean, my mind's just full of ghetto. It's all I've been growing up with.
About 10 miles from Patterson Tract is Charter Alternatives. It's located on a country road across the street from Orchards. When we visited the school this summer, the campus was quiet and peaceful. But most of Geronimo's memories of school were hazy.
Marijuana was around me since I was a little kid. I brought it in school. I sold it in school. I got caught with it at school. I smoked it at school.
And it clouded his performance in school, says Scott Braden.
I saw in that 3-year period of time just the incredible drug use, and he became volatile, severely depressed. You just saw the life being sucked out of him.
Braden says Geronimo should have been at the expulsion school for one semester. The goal is to re-enroll students in a comprehensive school from which they can graduate. But Geronimo was there, on and off, for 3 years.
Geronimo didn't even really think that he'd live very long. That's just his mindset.
When Geronimo looks back on those years, he remembers violence. He stood by the benches where he used to hang out with his buddies.
It's all the old friends I used to see every day. Two of them are in prison for shooting the mall, and others are either dead or still in jail.
He pointed out where he got in a fight with a deputy sheriff.
It happened right here when I was fighting with the officer, with the sheriff. It happened right here next to the cafeteria. We were over here at first fighting, and we ended up on the ground over here.
He was suspended for 5 days and never returned to school after that. Geronimo's mentor, Manny Castro, repeatedly tells him that education is the path out of poverty and off the streets.
He's got to get to a point where he understands that he can do things better, or that there is another way of living rather than drugs, rather than gangs, rather than lack of education.
But Castro says leaving that lifestyle behind is a process, one that doesn't happen overnight. And Geronimo is, at best, halfway there. Now that he's not in school, he spends more time on the streets selling drugs.
It's really hard to get out of a life like this, but I haven't got out of it yet. Still doing the life.
Castro asks Geronimo to rate his desire to return to school on a scale of 1 to 10. He says he's a 5, in the middle. His outlook for the future falls on both sides of that spectrum. One afternoon, Geronimo envisions a dark fate. In 5 years, I ask him, does he see himself with a high school degree?
I don't think I am going to get my high school degree.
Or a GED or anything?
I don't think so.
Do you see yourself holding like a steady job?
Mm-mm.
Or having a family or anything?
I see Pierre Black. I don't see anything.
On a better day, though, Geronimo says he'll need a high school degree to get a legitimate job and a college degree to earn the job he wants in law enforcement. Inspired by the TV show Border Wars, Geronimo says he wants to join the Arizona Border Patrol.
Like, you're just out there walking in the desert looking for somebody, and you have your gun on your side. I don't know. I think it would be fun just by catching somebody, you know, trying to cross over the border.
And that's why Castro says he won't give up on Geronimo.
You see the fact that he knows he wants something better for himself. And we talk about that. We talk about it openly. But it's got to come to him on his own, because that's when it's going to mean something for him.
At this point, Geronimo has a rope in his hands. It could drag him deeper into a life on the streets. Or it could be the lifeline that Castro has cast out to him. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Rebecca Plevin.
And Rebecca Plevin joins us in the studio, and I should add that report is a collaboration between Valley Public Radio and our friends at Capital Public Radio's documentary unit, The View From Here, and they'll be premiering their own version of this story later this week on their station in Sacramento. Rebecca, how did this come about? I understand you started looking at this story of education and dropouts in the Valley and discovered Geronimo.
That's right. So this, as you mentioned, was part of Capital Public Radio's upcoming documentary called Class Dismissed, and is looking at the high school dropout crisis in California's Central Valley. And they asked me to find someone who had dropped out of high school. And it actually took me a little while to find someone who was open to sharing their story and who had a good story to share. And I eventually connected with Manny Castro, who we heard in the story, and he connected me with Geronimo. And I think he represented not just the issue of dropout, of just dropping out of high school, but all the other factors that cause a youth to struggle in school and drop out.
Manny Castro joins us now on the phone. He was the gang intervention specialist who is working with Geronimo that we heard featured in the report. Manny, welcome to our program today.
Thank you. Good morning.
Rebecca described this as a tug of war between the forces pulling on Geronimo from different sides, those who are in his gang and the other influences that pull him towards a life on the streets, and folks like you who are working with him to try to show him that there is a better way and there is a way out. What was your first impression when you first met Geronimo?
Well, Geronimo is a young man I met at the Whitman Center here in Visalia. I worked there part-time as a gang interventionist in the evening. And he's just one of those young men that you see something in their eyes. You know, they live the life they live. They do the things they do, but when you're able to build a relationship with them and you talk to them and you partner with them, you see something different in them. When you actually give them an opportunity to be young men and the children that they are, you see things. I mean, you can see the twinkle in their eye. You can see a smile on their face when you talk about certain things. And that's what I look for, and that's what I've seen in Geronimo. And, you know, we've built a relationship ever since then.
One of the things that struck me in listening to the report and talking with Rebecca and going over what all the work that goes into producing one of these things is Geronimo, it surprises me when I hear his story. Sometimes it's very troubling. Sometimes I see rays of light there. I imagine you see that same thing. You know, you hear him on one hand say, I don't see anything in my future. And on the other hand, you hear him talking about wanting to pursue a career in law enforcement. Is that both encouraging or frustrating for you because you see that and then you see the other side?
Well, it's both. You know, there's time when you see that glimmer of hope, it's yes, he's getting it, he's understanding it. And then several days later we talk and it's a totally different perspective. But see, that's what keeps us going as interventionists and as youth workers. That's what keeps us going is when you can have that bright spot and when you can hear him, you know, voice the words, I want to do something different. And again, it comes back to the relationship and just being able to keep that relationship going and hoping that the bright spots will be a little more in between the dark spots, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. You know, we're looking for a little more positive stuff in between the dark things that he has to go through and in between all the influences and all the other stuff he has to deal with on the street. We're hoping to kind of to bridge that gap to where eventually he'll have three or four good days in a row, eventually a week, and then we're looking toward a month, and hope eventually get out of that cycle.
Now, Manny, your own personal story is an inspiration for many, and perhaps even Geronimo in this case. You had to struggle with many of these things when you were a young person growing up in Fresno County, correct?
Yeah. There was a lot of things that I had to deal with myself. You know, and if you heard part of the story, I grew up in the projects. I grew up with, you know, on food stamps and in a big family, and there was really nothing to do. You know, you go to school, you come home, you hang out in the hood, and this is what you do. It's normal. It's part of who you are. It becomes part of you. And anybody that that points at you and says, you know, what are you doing? You're doing something wrong. You know, you automatically assume that, well, I'm doing fine. You're the one that's got the problem.
Certainly. Again, Manny Castro, gang intervention specialist in Tulare County, joins us now. We're talking about Geronimo's story, a piece produced by Valley Public Radio and Capital Public Radio that ran earlier today, and Rebecca Plevin, the reporter, joins us, as well as Caroline Garcia. She is with Youth Build Program. She's a program manager there with the local Conservation Corps. Caroline, you see a lot of folks who are young people that are struggling with what path they're going to take in life. How do you see Geronimo's story? Is that something that's typical of many kids that you deal with in the Valley?
It is. It's very typical. I would say 99.9% of my participants are gang-involved, gang-related. And so it's about the expectation from their family, their friends, for them to be involved in a gang. So it's very typical within our valley and throughout the nation. It's a huge problem.
Certainly so. And Rebecca, tell me a little more about the challenges of reporting this story. This has been a months-long project. And this wasn't an easy one, both from the content of the report. I mean, this is some very powerful stuff. Geronimo's brother was killed just a few months ago in Visalia in a shooting that folks believe is probably gang-related. This had to be a difficult one from a reporter's perspective.
From a reporter's perspective, it was a pretty difficult story to report. Luckily, I did have the help of someone Manny, who was able to connect me with Geronimo and sort of keep us connected. But I would say that some of the challenges of reporting the story is that there weren't a lot of places where I could interview Geronimo. We hear about his life on the streets, but obviously that's not a place that I could go and interview him. We hear about his home life, but that wasn't a place, again, that I could really go interview him. And so most of our interviews happened at the Whitman Center, the place that Manny mentioned. It's a community center in Visalia. Or we spend a lot of time in the car, too. And that's why you hear a lot of car sounds in that story, is we spend some time just driving through Visalia, and we did interviews there as well.
Let's bring the conversation back to where we started with the initial concept behind this piece, and that was education and dropouts. This has to be a big challenge. Caroline, I'd like to hear your perspectives on that when it comes to kids that are struggling between life on the streets and trying to have a brighter future, shall we say. What do you see in terms of dropouts and gangs in our communities? Those two things are pretty closely connected.
Right. They're hand in hand. And so with that, I ask the experts, which are my participants, and I often get responses such as, well, you know, I was bullied and picked on, so I'd rather join the gang, earn some money selling maybe drugs or committing, you know, minor crimes, breaking into cars, selling things, because they want the nice shoes, the nice clothes that the other kids have that they don't have. And then there's the whole other aspect of family. And so family, they feel entitled to be a part of that gang. Education is not a priority, especially from the family dynamic or even the their environment at school and that dynamic, being bullied and so forth. And it's about peer pressure. So a lot of the peer pressure, education is not a priority. And so what I see is that they need an opportunity. It's when they find that one person that believes in them, and they go from there. And that's what I think our program's about, the Local Conservation Corps and Youth Build Program, because it's about what the students call a second chance to complete their education.
I want to turn to Manny Castro now. Manny, in the piece, you talk about Geronimo. You talk to him all the time about how education is the path out, but you say it's a choice that he has to make on his own. I know you work really hard to try to show him experiences that are outside of what he grew up with and show him that there are other opportunities, other things that he can do. How do you think education fits into this, and are you optimistic that Geronimo will someday get that GED?
Well, you know, we have to be optimistic with every student that we come across. Education, then that's where I do most of my work, is within the educational system. And a lot of times, especially gang members, feel alienated from the school system. You know, there's really not a place for them in public education. But at the same time, we have to reach out to them. So my hope for Geronimo is that as long as we keep exposing him to different experiences and we keep him keep the dream alive, if that makes sense, to get an education, to get the diploma, to continue seeking higher education and doing something better with your life. That's the hope that we have for every student, including Geronimo. And again, there's always those, Rebecca can attest to this, there's always these bright moments when Geronimo's eyes light up. And there was a time also during an interview when he talked about making a pipe out of a regular pencil, and I'm thinking, I mean, who thinks of that? How much ingenuity does it take for somebody to think of making a pipe out of a pencil?
That was one of my favorite interview moments, actually.
yeah, and it's things like that that for me as an interventionist, as a youth worker, that just that keeps me going. That pumps me up, and it lets me know that what we're doing has a purpose and that we're headed somewhere. You know, but it's moments like that, you know, and especially with in reference to Geronimo, where things are changing in his mind. He's working cognitively. Things are changing, and as I talk to Rebecca throughout the month, the whole thing is a process. It is a huge developmental process that we just have to be patient. We can't push. We have to pull, and we just have to be there. I tell my students, I'm here for you 24/7. I've gotten phone calls at 2 or 3 in the morning. I've had kids sleep on my couch. But this is what we have to do. We have to go the extra mile. We have to do the things that other organizations or that other people aren't willing to do. And that's what these kids are looking for. They're looking for a connection. Somebody's going to go the extra mile for them.
We're talking about gangs, drugs, poverty, education, all of the biggest issues that face so many communities here in the Valley. Manny Castro, who's a gang intervention specialist in Tulare County, joins us on the telephone, as well as Rebecca Plevin here in our studio and Caroline Garcia. And we'll, in just a moment, bring in Deputy Ralph Polinelli from the Fresno County Sheriff's Department. He's a detective with the MAJIC unit, and we'll get to him in a moment. But you know, you were talking about in the piece, Manny, about how there are certain cultural hooks, certain ties that bind Geronimo to a life on the streets, to the life that he's living right now, selling drugs, a hustler on the streets. You know, his brothers, as you opened up the piece, Rebecca, his brothers were dressing him up in a gang outfit when he was 7 years old. That seems like such a high burden to overcome. How do you do that when you have family and so many other ties that are the closest ties we will ever have, pulling him in that direction? I know you've served as something of a father figure for him, but how do you deal with that? Because no one ever loses their family, but for Geronimo's future, it's very very it's a very difficult situation.
Well, that's one thing that we always have to contend with, and we just have to be persistent, and again, just look for any opportunity that we have to interject something positive, to expose them to something different, other than what the generation that he comes from has exposed him to. I personally work for the moment of opportunity, and it's just taking that time and just hoping that, again, I always have to refer to the process. You know, we all wish there was, you know, a program that we can take them to over the weekend and have everything just kind of change, but unfortunately things don't work that way. But that's the main thing that we contend against every day, is the generational factors, the brother that dressed him up, you know, the brother that is deceased, the brother that sells drugs. That's one thing we're always up against. But again, the most powerful thing for us is the relationship. And as Rebecca can tell you, I never pushed Geronimo into saying anything. I never pushed him or tried to convince him in any way, shape, or form of something that he's got to do. I'm simply pushing him along or pulling him along and saying, we have this, we have this, we can do this, we can do this. And eventually something's going to catch his eye. Eventually something's going to attract that young man that is going to make the change and is going to lead him on a better path. That's what we always hope for.
You know, on the surface of these things, we always hear about gangs in the news and when there's a tragedy, a tragic act of violence, and it's very easy to hear a story about a young gang member who has done some things that most of us would shudder at, and it's very easy to write them off. But I think that's one of the things that we're talking about in this piece is that there is a future and that future isn't necessarily determined. And Caroline, I'd like to hear your thoughts on that before I turn to Deputy Polinelli.
So with that, my program recruits behind the walls, and I'm going to start with that. And what that means is we go into the youth authorities, jails, prisons, the JJC, and we begin the relationship there. And we provide them with information on our program and what that's going to look like for them. Some of them have challenges with housing. A lot of them just say, you know, there's no hope. But that's what we go and do. We provide the hope of finishing your education, paid vocational training and construction or other areas of what we do. And all of a sudden they have a plan. And it's like, oh, gosh, now I have something to look forward to. Now, getting them there once they're released and struggling with that, the family and the other dynamics or the influences is a little bit of a challenge at times. But it's about the money for them and wanting to change and have that second chance. So providing them with some services, housing, we even help them with housing and a lot of other things. And so trying to break down those barriers and for them to develop a plan, a transition plan, I think has been instrumental in some of the ones that we've worked with to find out what success looks like.
Speaking of these things, let's turn to Deputy Ralph Polinelli. He's a detective with the Fresno County Sheriff's Department's Anti-Gang Task Force, the MAGIC unit. What role does law enforcement play in these situations? These are obviously, you know, every situation is different, but when it comes to trying to be proactive in dealing with gang problems and trying to break some of these ties, what do you see as the best possible approaches?
Again, with law enforcement going out into the neighborhoods, talking with the gang members themselves, we do that on a daily basis in MAGIC. We have several teams that go out on a daily basis, getting to find out some of the trends, talking with the youth, because a lot of the gang members we do encounter are between the ages of 12 and 18 years old, so that's where it starts. So it's getting to build relationships with some of those gang members and then talking with the older gang members who are actually dropped out of the gang, and getting information from them also.
Yeah, those are definitely things. And I think one of the things that Manny brought up is these aren't necessarily dumb kids. I think you listen to Geronimo's story. He's very intelligent. He's actually pretty articulate for an 18-year-old kid, much more so than many 18-year-olds I've met. Talk about that and the role that education plays in this. And when students disengage from that system, the challenges that then present themselves.
Again, I'll go back to what was discussed earlier. A lot of these kids are grown up in the neighborhoods, a lot of poverty. You're looking at kids that are becoming fourth and fifth generation. Their families are gang members. Their grandparents are gang members. So that's all they've ever known. We go into these houses and we're finding pictures of these kids being dressed up when they're at a young age. So it's kind of hard to change the hearts and minds of some of the children out there because that's all they know, and we come into their neighborhoods for 10 hours and do our proactive gang enforcement, and then we're out of the neighborhood. So they have the peer pressure not only from the neighborhood but from the gang members that run those neighborhoods where they live in. So it's really tough for those kids to get away from that. But again, education, mentors, a lot of gang prevention programs that have been actually pulled out of the schools due to budget cuts, it's kind of hurting that. So hopefully we can get some of the funding back for that.
Yeah, Manny, hear your thoughts on that side of things. When it comes to law enforcement, what do you feel that law enforcement maybe could do better when it comes to dealing with these issues?
Well, in terms of law enforcement, we do need law enforcement for the suppression aspect. And as far as in the county that I live in, I just think we need a better relationship with all the organizations that are doing intervention prevention services. We have to formulate some type of a wraparound service to where, students or gang members that are out in the street doing what they do, that if they talk to me and I have a message and then they talk to, the deputy and they have a message and they talk to a police officer on the street who's part of the gang force unit, If they can hear a consistent message, if they can understand that we're all working together, to try to help them, not to try to, you know, to continue suppressing them and just locking them up and not offering them any services. I think eventually, you know, they would begin to understand. But there's just, it's got to be a collaborative. As I believe it was the deputy said, we got to work together somehow to find more resources, you know. And being that we're such a large county and that we're so spread out, you have, you know, several different organizations doing their own little thing. But if we were able to build some type of consortium or collaborative and come together with the same message, with the same future, we might be able to make a little more impact on these kids, because, you know, it's difficult, I would think, for a student to get away if the officer and the deputy and the interventionist and the teacher and the nonprofits all have the same message. I would think that eventually that would help them to understand that there is a better way and there are different things to do in life.
What do you think about that, Deputy Polinelli? Is there a way that we can coordinate our efforts better and maybe get all on one voice when it comes to these things? Because there's so many people, even just evidenced by the people here at our table today and on the air, who are working on these issues, but kids fall through the cracks.
I agree. I've been working with gang members for 11 years. And when I first started 11 years ago as a young deputy, you know, my goal was to go out and arrest as many gang members as I could. But the problem was when I was going out into the neighborhoods 3 and 4 years later, I was out arresting the same kids again, and they were getting out of YA, getting out of juvenile hall. So, yes, we can't arrest our way out of this problem. We've said that before. There's got to be other alternatives for these kids. And again, the hardcore gang members, yes, we do need to get them locked up and put away, people that are violent and they're just going to continue with the gang life. But these kids like Geronimo here, who are on the fence, who could go either way. I've seen that time and time again. And again, I know with the county of Fresno, we've lost what we had a gang czar, and the funding for that has disappeared. I know the Fresno Police Department does have a gang prevention intervention unit. But again, I think the funding has been reduced a lot. In fact, the funding for our unit has been reduced. So when that happens, a lot of problems will continue. So, again, working with nonprofit groups, the clergy, former gang members. We also talk with a lot of former gang members, bringing all those people together. And, again, I agree with the gentleman on the phone that if we could all send the same message, then these kids are going to kind of buy into what we're trying to sell them, and hopefully that's going to change their ways.
Manny, before we go, one final question. How do you define success, and what do you see as success in this situation, whether it's Geronimo or any of the other kids that you've worked with over the years?
Well, that's kind of a big question, and it's kind of hard to put a definition on it. But from where I sit, it would be education. Education would definitely give a lot more kids, a lot more students, and we'll call them gang members if. For the sake of the conversation, it would definitely give them an edge, and it'll definitely give them a different perspective and a sense of accomplishment to say, I did it. You know, I've been doing this for probably 8 years now, and I'm just now beginning to see a cycle of the kids I worked with, you know, 4, 5, 6 years ago. You know, I see them at Walmart, I see them on the street, and I see them at church, and they're like, hey, Manny, guess what? I'm doing something different. And, you know, and I want to do everything but jump out of my shoes. But, you know, I got to stay cool. And I said, come and give him a hug and say, I know you can do it. I knew you can do it. And you know, and you go home and you have a smile on your face and everything is good.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, if that answers your question, that's kind of how I could define success for myself and for my students.
Definitely constitutes a happy ending in stories like this. Well, we've been joined today on the phone by Manny Castro. He's a gang intervention behavior specialist, currently with Visalia Unified School District and formerly with Youth for Christ in Tulare County. Also joining us in our studio, Caroline Garcia with the Youth Build Program in the Local Conservation Corps, and Deputy Ralph Polinelli from the Fresno County Sheriff's Department's Magic Anti-Gang Unit. He's a detective with the unit. Thank you all so much for joining us today on Valley Edition.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
We'll be back in just a moment on our program. Stay tuned. We'll talk about plans for a new power plant in Kern County that promises to turn coal into clean energy. It's generating a bit of controversy, but also excitement from some people with concerns about the economy. That's all coming up in just a moment here on Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Kern County has long been the state's leader when it comes to the energy industry. Oil and more recently wind and solar have been big business in the South Valley and have helped provide for a relatively booming economy, at least compared with the rest of the San Joaquin Valley. But a new power plant that backers promised would bring low carbon energy to the state has folks from farmers to air quality activists crying foul. It also promises to bring a lot of jobs to the region. Last week, I went to Kern County and brought you this report. In the small Kern County community of Tupman, the 2013 pistachio harvest is well underway.
The machinery grabs the tree and shakes it, but the machine itself has wrapped around the entire tree, and so it collects every nut. We don't let the nuts touch the ground.
Chris Romanini's family has been farming this land just west of Interstate 5, where the valley's fields meet the Elk Hills, for decades.
Depending on the maturity of the nut, it might take 5 seconds. That's a 4-second shake.
It's probably not the first place you'd think of when it comes to the effort to reduce CO2 emissions and combat global warming. But just a few hundred yards away from this orchard, plans for a $4 billion power plant and fertilizer factory could soon make the Tupman area known for a lot more than those pistachios. It's called Hydrogen Energy California.
This is a project that has a lot of national and global attention, primarily for its goal of generating power with a low carbon footprint.
That's Tiffany Rao, spokesperson for the project, which is owned by Massachusetts-based SCS Energy. The 300-megawatt plant would be powered by coal and refinery waste. But instead of burning the fuel like a traditional coal plant, it would be transformed into something called syngas, and ultimately
into a clean-burning hydrogen fuel in order to make electricity for the power grid in California.
But it doesn't stop there. In fact, that's just the beginning.
In the process of doing that, rather than venting the CO2 into the atmosphere, which would become a greenhouse gas emission, the technology captures and then stores it into a nearby oil field.
The owner of that field, Occidental Petroleum, would then use that pressurized CO2 to get more oil out of its wells. The idea of sealing up our unwanted CO2 deep inside the earth has a lot of people excited, including President Obama, who 3 years ago called for 10 commercial plants to be operable by 2016.
We can develop the technology to capture the carbon pollution released by coal. It can create jobs and provide energy well into the future.
That's one reason why this Kern County plant is set to receive $408 million from the U.S. Department of Energy as part of a cost-sharing agreement. But there's another big part of this project, fertilizer.
A lot of people don't know that in California, we import about 90% or more of our fertilizer into the state, and 32% of that actually comes from out of the country.
The plant will have the capacity to produce up to 1 million tons per year. It wasn't originally part of the project, but was added by SCS to make the plant financially viable. Project officials say when electricity demand is low, the plant will produce urea, and when it's high, electricity.
All of this adds up to one of the most complex industrial facilities that California has ever seen, according to Carl Bauer, former director of the Department of Energy's National Energy Technology Laboratory and now an energy industry consultant.
So he is kind of leading the way with technologies that have actually been proven to be viable, but they have not been integrated in the way that HEEC is doing it. So that's kind of a first of a kind. It's actually one of the cleanest plants in the world and also one of the first plants to really come forth and address things in a different way.
But the idea of putting a new power plant and chemical factory in the middle of one of the worst air basins in the country has many people concerned.
This project is not right for Kern County. It's not right for California.
Evan Gillespie is a deputy director with the Sierra Club's Beyond Coal campaign.
The project, as proposed, would rail coal from New Mexico on diesel trains straight through South Bakersfield, where it would then potentially get on trucks that would deliver the coal to the project, where the project would then gasify the coal, pouring obscene amounts of new pollution into the air, into the dirtiest air basin in the country.
So how to explain the dramatically differing views on the cleanliness of this plant when it comes to air quality? Well, it turns out the truth is somewhere in between. I spoke with Dave Warner, the director of permit services for the Valley Air District. Even with the company's efforts to capture 90% of the CO2 the plant will produce, Warner admits it'll be a major source of just about every sort of pollution.
In fact, anytime you have a combustion process, you will produce nitrogen oxides, carbon monoxide and carbon dioxide, sulfur oxides, particulate matter, air toxic emissions as well.
But despite that, earlier this year, the Air District found that the project is in compliance with all district emission offsetting regulations and won't cause any violations of the federal air quality standards. The key word there is offsetting. The plant proposes to offset those emissions, ultimately claiming to be a net benefit to the region's air quality.
The mitigation proposal that we made to HECA was for them to contribute a total of almost $9 million into the funds that we use to directly achieve emission reductions from those sources like tractors and trucks.
Still, that doesn't satisfy many project opponents, like Chris Romanini, the pistachio farmer we heard from earlier. She's one of the project's most vocal critics.
This is on prime farmland, and it is surrounded by food crops. Coal has heavy metals in it, mercury and other things that if it gets loose and if it gets into our fields, we don't want to see food crops contaminated.
She's also worried about the project's impact on local water supplies. The plant will use up to 7,500 acre-feet of water per year. The project has a deal with a local water district to use what it calls brackish water, which would otherwise have to be cleaned up. But Romanini and others say the water in question is more than good enough to grow crops with.
This is usable water, and we are in overdraft in Kern County.
And she says the environmental benefits of the power plant are outweighed by the fertilizer component of the project.
So when they are making fertilizer, they're actually sucking 62 megawatts out of the grid. Do you know fertilizer actually is something that the state is starting to regulate because they say farmers use too much of it?
The plant will also produce other byproducts, including 220 tons per day of sulfur and 850 tons a day of gasification solids. Some of that could be used in products from shingles to concrete, but much of it could wind up in a landfill. Still, despite the drawbacks, project supporters like Carl Bauer say it's a necessary step for California to meet its clean energy goals and to make an effort at reducing global warming.
I think this project is one of the few projects that are looking at demonstrating this is something we can do, and it's the more we do it, the more we'll both reduce greenhouse gas and the more we'll be able to get the costs to be even less expensive.
And Tiffany Rao says if the project ultimately receives all of the necessary approvals from the California Energy Commission, the boost to the local economy would be huge.
We expect 2,400 jobs during peak construction, so it's a significant employer.
The commission will hold its next hearing in the project's lengthy approval process Tuesday evening at the Button Willow Recreation and Park District's multipurpose facility. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Joe Moore.
Kept
us humble and made all of truth.
But plans that we make up some.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. That's the sound of Rose Maddox and Buck Owens, two musical icons of California's Central Valley. As one of the first artists to span the gap between country and rock and carve out musical territory we know today as rockabilly, Rose Maddox's story is one of those featured in a new exhibit that opens this month at the Merced Multicultural Arts Center. It's called Central Valley Threads, Picking Out the Strands of Life and Art in the Central Valley. It looks at everything from poverty to poetry, music, food, and fashion, basically what makes this region unique. The exhibit is a collaboration between professors at UC Merced and UC Davis. Joining us now to tell us more about this exhibit is one of its organizers, Michael Isinger, a graduate student at UC Merced. Michael, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
How did the idea for this exhibit come about?
We do a great deal of work at UC Merced on community-engaged research. And much of what we do is looking at our area. You know, I mean, if we were in Los Angeles, we'd be looking at Los Angeles. We happen to be in the Central Valley, so we do. So many of us do research that is localized. My research is here. Jan Goggins, who is the primary organizer, she's very interested in Oki poets and that type of thing. She's involved in literature. Most of us approach our studies looking at people rather than at politicians or institutions or whatever. And so we're much more at the social level, much more at the ground roots. And so that's kind of the foundation that this is built on. It's also much more geared to working class studies and poverty and things like that. And those were the things we wanted to look at. And I think that what we've done is approached from a bunch of different directions and asked more questions than we've got any answers. So.
Fascinating. When we talk about Central Valley culture, what does that mean to you?
Well, a lot of different things. I mean, my particular research, I focus on a 17 or 18 historically rural African-American communities out in the middle of the cotton fields on the edges of small towns. I have colleagues that work with the homeless in downtown Fresno. I have friends that work on, like I said, Oki poets or that look at rockabilly and hillbilly music that was very popular here, or want to talk about how Buck Owens was the first country artist to ever use an electric guitar, and he was essentially the Bob Dylan of country music, going over to the devil side. There's a lot of different things here. Whether it is farm labor, and in farm labor, you're talking about the Chinese in the 1880s, and African Americans in the 1880s, 1890s, and Hispanics and Filipinos, and it's a very, very rich, very, very diverse culture. And I don't think you can say that there's a Central California culture. Too often, the history is about the businesses that came in or the Poplarville remembers. That's all important stuff, but there's a history that's at a much deeper level, and that's what we're trying to look at here. The people who got their hands dirty, the people who really built what those other people built things on top of. And I think that's what we're looking at here is really working class people and laborers and people off the street.
Do you think that there's sometimes a tendency by those who live here, especially those who have lived here a long time, you often hear people say, Central Valley culture, there is no there.
Right.
You know, there's not really a culture here in the Valley that we haven't contributed anything. You're bringing in people from outside the area, some great folks who are originally from the area like Gerald Haslam and others. There is something unique here, is there not?
There is a lot that's unique here. You know, Central California is one of those places you keep trying to move away from and you often get dragged back. Remember, cable cars were in Fresno before they made it to San Francisco. The first water park in the state was over on Blackstone, Zapp's Park. The Fresno scraper becomes the Caterpillar tractor. I mean, there's a lot here. And I think, so much of the time we think about what we don't have. I mean, there's many things that as an urban area would be great if we did have. But there's so much that we do have that we often turn our backs on. And so an exhibit like this where we're bringing in clothing, we're bringing in poetry, we're bringing in photographs, we've got film, we have a whole range of ways of looking at these things, I think will demonstrate that culture isn't always what we think of as high culture, opera and symphony, which we have, but culture is what makes you and me interact. It's how we interact. It's how we live and how we see our neighbors and live and play and work and die and love and fight and do all that stuff.
Well, let's talk about this exhibit that opens again on the 21st at the Merced Multicultural Arts Center in downtown Merced. We opened our segment today hearing some music from Rose Maddox. She's really an iconic figure in country and rockabilly circles, not all that well known today amongst the average person on the street in the Central Valley, but she had a huge impact in popular culture, popular music in the 1950s and 60s.
And in multiple ways. I mean, not only was that rockabilly, that combination of rhythm and blues that she brought in, partly because of her Southern background, but also in things as strange as fashion. You know, if you think of the classic, you know, the Porter Wagners and the Conway Twitties of the 50s and 60s with the sequins and the matador pants and the tight-fitting bolero jackets, that really starts with Rose Maddox and that group that are trying to carve out a unique niche.
And we should say Rose Maddox, born in the South in Alabama. Mm-hmm. Her family moved to California in the 1930s, it was, eventually settling in Modesto. And the Maddox Brothers and Rose was a huge band. And then later on, she went out on her own recording for Capitol Records and many others. How does she factor into this exhibit?
She's really Susan Kaiser, one of the participants from UC Davis, actually has an exhibit on hillbilly music and fashion, using Rose and her brothers as the core. And so there will be photographs, there'll be actual costumes, there'll be a number of things, and I believe there'll be music playing on and off.
One of those that's featured in your opening event on the 21st is one of the brightest stars in arts and letters from the Valley, and that's Oildale's Gerald Haslam. He now calls Sonoma County home, but he's coming back to the Valley for this event, and he's written quite eloquently about the Valley and many of the things that your exhibit is talking about. His book, Working Man's Blues, is a great document, a great book about California country music. Tell us about Gerald and his involvement with this exhibit.
Gerald is one of those people. He's written extensively about Central California. He's got a book called The Other 99. He's got Working Man's Blues. And there's another one I'm trying to remember off the top of my head. I've forgotten the other title. I know I've cited all of those books at one time or another in something I've written. But he is a local boy. He grew up in Oildale and in Taft. He writes about people working in the oil fields. He's written about the day that all the African Americans were chased out of Taft and had to be taken to Bakersfield under protective custody. And he's written essays, short stories, poetry, and he's now retired. But we invited him to come and give the keynote, the opening talk. And so on the 21st, the exhibit will be available in the main halls of the Multicultural Center. But for the opening evening, we will open with I think we have a country swing band that will open the program. Then Gerald will talk for about 30 minutes, and then we'll wrap it up with a local blues artist. And so the evening kind of touches on many different aspects of what then is involved in the rest of the exhibit.
Well, it sounds very exciting. Well, we're looking forward to it again. It's called Central Valley Threads, Life and Art in the Central Valley, September 21st through October 4th at the Merced Multicultural Arts Center in downtown Merced. It's a joint production of professors at UC Merced and at UC Davis, and you can find out more information about it online at centralvalleythreads.ucdavis.edu. Our guest has been Michael Isinger of UC Merced. Michael, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And that's all for this Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kvpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us, talk@kvpr.org. Of course, you can also follow us on your favorite social media sites. On Facebook, just type in Valley Public Radio, and we're there. Also, for those of you on Twitter, you can tweet us at KVPR and at Valley Edition. And even check us out on Instagram, for that matter, as well. For audio engineer Marv Allen, production and operations manager Don Weaver, and Valley Edition's reporter, Rebecca Plevin, I'm Joe Moore, our producer, Ezra Romero, as well. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. See you next week.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.